Hola. Now, I would like to share with you, because I'm sure it's there, unless it's magically disappeared since I looked a few minutes ago, this wonderful quote by Tsongkhapa. It's in his Medium Exposition of the Stages of the Path, and the translation of that was the core of my doctoral dissertation. Here's what he said. I find this very, very clear and utterly experiential. He said, "Then this is the way ideation vanishes, ideation as in, you know, just thoughts, wandering thoughts, and all of that. By placing the attention in the absence of mindfulness and mental engagement as before, like bubbles emerging from water, any ideation that arises cannot be prolonged in great diffusion, but naturally subsides. Then by practicing as before, without intentionally inhibiting them, experiential awareness and the sense of ongoing joy do not bear observation." And that is quite intense, I think, is what he's saying there. "Rather, like peeling bark, they naturally subside and are purified as soon as they arise. Joy in the experiential awareness then becomes subtle. At that time, while in meditative equipoise, no appearances of your own body and so on arise. And there is a sense as if the mind has become indivisible with space. When rising from that state, there is a sense as if the body is suddenly coming into being." So this brings us to our meditation, which I would indeed like to begin very soon. And among the different methods of shamatha, the one that has a faint analogy or is faintly parallel to Vajrayana practice in general is the shamatha without a sign. And when I say to Vajrayana practice, because what is characteristic of Vajrayana practice is that you're taking the fruition or bringing the fruition onto the path. You're kind of plucking it there. In a way, if you think in terms of time, you're reaching ahead and bringing the fruition into the path. Or if you think from deep another perspective, you're reaching down to the fruition, which is the ground, which is the path and the fruition. You're reaching down and taking the fruition as a path, right? Because the fruition is there. So from the perspective of a sentient being, Tsongkhapa, that is not Tsongkhapa, but what Tsongkhapa is presenting, is then you're reaching to the future, because your enlightenment is nowhere to be found now, but it will be in the future. And you're drawing that in the future, since time has no absolute existence anyway, why not? So you bring it into the present, or if we view this from a Dzogchen perspective, you take the fruition, which is already present, but simply obscured, and you draw it into the present and make that your path. Well, the practice of shamatha without a sign is not a Vajrayana practice. Facsimile of it, or something maybe perhaps even identical, is found in the Pali Canon, I think I've mentioned, among the 10 kasinas taught by the Buddha. And kasina means an emblem or a universality, one can almost say. That there is the Vijnana kasina, the emblem, the universality of consciousness itself, and you just focus on that, you rest in that. But here we are in Dzogchen, and so how is this similar? And that is, when we simply rest in awareness without directing attention to any other object outside of awareness itself, we're seeking in the very first moment of the practice to emulate the culmination of the practice. And the culmination of it was just described. Ideation has ceased, but not absolutely ceased. This is quite well known. That is, there's absolutely no excitation. I mean, zero excitation. You are pristine. Your samadhi is flawless. And overall, while resting in the substrate consciousness, it is said to be non-conceptual, but it's known when you look into the fine print that it's not absolutely non-conceptual. There are subtle, number one, subjectively, there can be a subtle degree of grasping, of preference for clinging to bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality. And clinging, the mental affliction of clinging, is always, it's a parasite that's always carried by a host, and host is conceptualization. So there has to be some subtle level of conceptualization subjectively here to be able to support the parasitic flow of the mental affliction of clinging to, grasping to, the bliss, luminosity, non-conceptuality. Yeah? So it can't be totally non-conceptual. But there's another way in which it's not totally non-conceptual, and that is, as you're just resting there, occasionally a little bubble, that's what he said, a little bubble of a thought will arise. But it's not subtle excitation, because there's just no perturbation at all, right? At all, zero. It's just coming up. And again, I always have this image coming up, because I had an aquarium when I was a kid, and you see sometimes a bubble coming from the surface, from the floor of the aquarium, and just kind of coming to the top and going boop. And the fish don't even notice. You know, there's just no perturbation there at all. There's no disturbance. It just comes up and then self-releases. And so thoughts will arise, but overwhelmingly, as he just described, you're simply resting in that, he said, absence of mindfulness, right? Very interesting, eh? So it really does look like there's one dharma here, doesn't it? I mean, we have Dzogchen, we have Asanga, we have Tsongkhapa. These are all living centuries apart from each other. And there they are saying the same thing. So it really gives a very strong impression. What do you think? Maybe I'm not just making this up. What do you think? Could it be? You know. And so this brings us to the practice. And the practice that I like, the method I like to focus on now, is going to be precisely the one that Yang Tanaboche taught. So just go back to your notes for that. And that is, he says, first of all, do not direct your attention outwards, because you're bound to be caught up in reification. Because that's what we do, right? Even sensations of your body, reify them. But direct your awareness inwards, right? So he just says that. I'm not quoting him directly here, but it's very close. Direct your attention inwards. So it's a little bit different, subtle nuance from the way Let Up Lingba taught it and so forth. But bring it inwards. And then as you're resting there inwards, awareness inverted in upon itself, I think exactly as Tsongkhapa described, then should a thought arise, let's say a thought arising relative to the past, what do you do? You let it be, and most specifically, number one, you have to recognize it so it doesn't suck you in. You recognize it just enough so that it doesn't suck you in, so you can follow his instructions, and that is, don't be snagged by it and then be drawn off to the past. And likewise, if some thought pertaining to the future arises, you have to note it, otherwise it may hook you. Note it just enough so that you don't get hooked, so that you do not follow that one in anticipation of some future thought. And likewise, for the thoughts buzzing around pertaining to the present. Yes, indeed, you just let them be. But to let them be, you must note them. And who was it that said, I think it was he who said, maybe in the commentary, don't let a single one pass by unnoticed. But then I asked him, so that was in his text and his oral commentary, but then I asked him, this method that you just taught, would you regard this as shamatha with a sign, as in attending to the space of the mind, attending to thoughts and so forth? There's a sign, there's a vector. Or is it shamatha without a sign? I asked him that. What was his answer? Without a sign, yeah. He said without a sign. Right? So I think when a vidyadhara speaks, we really want to listen very, very carefully, because you don't get that chance very often. So I'm just relaying that. That's it. I'm the secretary. But that's what he said. So let's go to the practice right now. Find a comfortable posture, and I'll give a little bit of guidance. The more deeply you can relax in your body, the more effortlessly you can breathe, and the more deeply you set your mind at ease, as you settle your body, speech, and mind in the natural states, the more effectively you'll be able to engage in the main practice. It's really the preliminary practice, ever so important. And I will seek to bring forth our closest facsimile or approximation to having already achieved shamatha, to resting in the luminosity of the substrate consciousness, in a space of awareness that is virtually empty of appearances, with just an occasional thought here or there, bubbling up and releasing itself with no perturbation, no excitation. So now, to the best of your ability, to approximate this, withdraw the light of your awareness away from the surrounding environment, the physical universe and its inhabiting sentient beings. Withdraw into retreat. Into the somatic field of your body. Retreat again into the space of the mind. Withdraw from the space of the mind, withdraw from all the activities of the mind. Release all interest in the mind. And let your awareness come to rest in its own place. So rest simply in the flow of being aware, of being aware, of being aware. And while resting right there in the light of your own awareness, should any thought arise of any kind, while resting primarily simply in the awareness of awareness itself, peripherally, simply note the occurrence of the thought with no interest at all in the content, the referent, the meaning of the thought. Simply note its presence, just enough. So that you enable it to release itself. And continually rest, to the best of your ability, in this simple flow of the awareness of being conscious, aware of the sheer luminosity, the sheer cognizance of consciousness itself. It is shamatha with no referent outside of awareness itself. Sustain that flow of mindful awareness without distraction, without grasping, and let's continue in silence. Bhavanasa. So now we turn to the long awaited for description, or actually descriptions from different perspectives of the actual achievement of shamatha. And particularly in this Indo-Tibetan tradition, that phrase, achieving shamatha, quite clearly refers, if you're drawing on the gold standard, I mean, what does it really mean? It's referring to, as you well know, I think, access to the first jhana or threshold to the first jhana. Those are synonymous. So I'd like to make just a brief foray, first of all, into the Theravada tradition, to the most authoritative commentator in that tradition, Buddhaghosa, who lived in the 5th century, and he gives quite a definitive explanation in his classic piece, its monumental piece, The Path of Purification. And so he's giving a distinction, he's drawing a distinction now here that is made in the Theravada tradition, and it's also made in the Indo-Tibetan Mahayana tradition, but it's not found in the Pali Canon. It's not found in the Buddhist teachings as set forth in the Pali Canon, and that is the difference between access concentration and the full absorption or the full achievement of jhana, that distinction. There's no question in my mind that it's real, but the Buddha didn't refer to it. But yogis for the last 2,500 years or so have noted it, and they've drawn this distinction because it's useful. Here's what Buddhaghosa says, and I quote, "The difference between the two kinds of concentration, namely access concentration and absorption, that is full achievement, is this. The factors, these are the five jhana factors, you go back and review those if you've not memorized them, the factors are not strong in access. That is, they're not strong relative to their robustness, their strength. Once you fully achieve the first jhana, all five of them are there. They're at your fingertips, and that single-pointedness, sense of well-being, bliss, coarse examination, and subtle analysis. You've got them all at your fingertips. They're useful, but they're more robust, more stable in once you've fully achieved the first jhana. The factors are not strong in access. It is because they are not strong that when access has arisen, the mind now makes the sign its object and now re-enters the ground of becoming." Okay, now makes the sign. This takes a little bit of contextualization. I have covered this in my book, in the Attention Revolution. And that is, in this context in Theravada, Buddhaghosa is very strongly emphasizing repeatedly, whether you're focusing on mindfulness of breathing or very explicitly when you're focusing on any of the 10 kasinas. And it's a very, very fascinating array of practices there. I'm going to be extremely brief. 10 kasinas are the four elements: earth, water, fire, air. Four primary colors: white, yellow, red, blue. And then, according to the Buddha, not Buddhaghosa, because he tweaks it a little bit, according to the Buddha, the final two kasinas, these are universal emblems, one could almost say like archetypes, are space and consciousness. Those are 10. And it's possible to achieve shamatha, access to the first jhana, and proceed beyond that using any of these kasinas. For each of these, it entails attending to a preliminary sign, at least for most of them, if not all of them, a preliminary sign in the sense, in terms of mindfulness of breathing, is the actual sensations of the breath. Then there comes the acquired sign that arises spontaneously. It's purely a mental image. And then when you achieve the counterpart sign, and this is a sign, a mental image that's emerging from the form realm. That's 1,000 times more subtle than the earlier acquired sign. That's what he's referring to. When he says sign here, he's referring to the counterpart sign. So, to read this again, they're not strong, these five jhana factors, they're not strong. It is because they're not strong that when access has arisen, you have achieved shamatha. Access has risen. You've achieved access to the first jhana. The mind now takes the sign as its object. It gets it. That is, it connects with, engages with the counterpart sign, and then it loses it. It loses it. The mind now makes the sign its object and now re-enters the ground of becoming, the bhavanga. So it slips in and out, right? Just as when a young child is lifted up and stood on its feet, it repeatedly falls down on the ground. So you've achieved shamatha now, and that counterpart sign has arisen, but it's so subtle that your awareness falls back. It's just so subtle, it's hard to maintain the continuity of attention to it, and you fall back, and you fall on your bum. You fall back into the bhavanga, and that sign disappears. So But the factors are strong in absorption, in the full achievement of the first jhana. It is because they are strong that when absorption and concentration has arisen, the mind, once having interrupted the flow of the ground of being, and that is engaged with a meditative object, carries on with a stream of wholesome impulsion, that is continuous ongoing engagement with this very, very subtle sign, counterpart sign. It carries on with a stream of wholesome impulsion for a whole night and a whole day, just as a healthy man, after rising from his seat, could stand for a whole day. That is the gold standard for the Theravada tradition. I don't know why it's not more commonly acknowledged, but that's it. As Tsongkhapa is for the Galupa. I mean, there are many, many outstanding Galupa scholars. But when it's all said and done, if it's not Tsongkhapa, it's not Galupa, and he is the gold standard. I would say Buddha Gosa is that for the Theravada. And so he's just described what's it like, what's the robustness of your samadhi if you fully achieve the first jhana, 24 hours straight, flawless. That's what it is. So hardly, that was a little, that's having not achieved the full jhana access, and then you fall to the ground. Okay. A little bit more here. As from Buddha Gosa again. As a result of practicing shamatha, the obscurations eventually become suppressed. The five obscurations, you know them well. The defilements subside. The mind becomes concentrated with access concentration, and the counterpart sign arises. The counterpart sign appears as if breaking out from the learning sign or the acquired sign. It's like one shatters, and then like almost like an egg, and it shatters, and it comes out of that. But it's coming from another dimension of existence, from the form realm, an archetypal realm. So the sign appears as if breaking out from the learning sign or the acquired sign, and 100 times, 1,000 times more purified, like a looking glass disc, drawn from its case, like a mother of pearl dish, well washed, like the moon's disc coming out from behind a cloud, like cranes against a thundercloud. Yes, but it has neither color nor shape. For if it had, it would be cognizable by the eye, gross, susceptible of comprehension, and stamped with the three characteristics. In other words, it would be ordinary, be something three characteristics, you know them, impermanence, dukkha, and anatta. It would be ordinary, it'd be back in the desire realm. But your mind in the desire realm, just like the intellect can't wrap itself around Rigpa, the mind in the desire realm cannot wrap itself around, cannot imagine a sign that's emerging from an entirely different dimension of existence. Just like if you were a flatlander, you lived in a two-dimensional world, you could not imagine anything in the third dimension. Once you're in the third dimension, you don't have to imagine it at all. You just see it. Once you've realized Rigpa, you don't have to try to imagine Rigpa. You just experience it. But it is not like that. For it is born only of perception in one who has obtained concentration. Concentration in here means jhana, being a mere mode of appearance. But as soon as it arises, the obscurations are quite suppressed, the defilements subside, and the mind becomes concentrated in access concentration. So he's now just given exactly what he means. What does it mean to achieve access concentration? Right? Now, I won't elaborate on this. You can find it easily. And his text is, the translation is free as a PDF online. You can get it. And one very nice thing about the version is you can use a search. So you can find whatever you want just by typing in a phrase, and then you can find wherever it occurs, and it's very, very useful. And just by the way, Nyanamoli, who translated the text, translates Bhavanga as life hyphen continuum, in case you wanted to check that out. So quite brilliant. And he says, and I'm not quoting it here, but he says, when you first achieve access concentration, that occurs when that counterpart sign arises, he said, if you can, hold on for dear life. Don't lose it. And if you don't, in that very session in which you've achieved access to the first jhana, if you hold on for dear life and stabilize on that very, very subtle appearance of the counterpart sign, then you may slip right into full achievement of the first jhana. So if you can do it, you can do it right there, as we say, lickety-split, right there on the spot. But many people can't. They lose it, and then you have to put in some real work. Because in a way, you have to achieve shamatha all over again, but now on this extremely subtle object. That's that. So now we move to Mahayana. And here, Tsongkhapa cites, and I quote, from the Samdhinimocana Sutra, one of the most famous of the Mahayana Sutras. Here's my translation, but Tsongkhapa cites it in his medium exposition of the path, the stages of the path. So here, Lord, when a bodhisattva directs his attention inwards, with the mind focused upon the mind, as long as physical pliancy and mental pliancy are not achieved, what is that mental activity called? And the person asking the question is Maitreya, asking this of Buddha Shakyamuni. And the Buddha replies, Buddha Shakyamuni replies, Maitreya, this is not shamatha. It is said to be associated with an aspiration that is a facsimile of shamatha. This is a really, really crucial point, and given about, you know, the most robust source you can find. And that is a term I haven't mentioned much at all, and Tsongkhapa highlights it, clarifies it, to my mind, in almost an unparalleled fashion. It's so brilliant and so precise. We have relaxation, stability, vividness. Along the path, as I've mentioned so many times, you're bound to experience spikes of really deep relaxation, real deep stillness, great vividness, and also joy. So bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality. You'll experience spikes of those. We know that, yeah? But there's, in addition to these three salient features of the substrate consciousness, bliss, luminosity, non-conceptuality, that you'll experience in spikes, more frequent spikes, longer spikes along the path, and then the grand finale when they're all blooming at the same time, when you achieve shamatha, in addition to that. And this is clear only in the Mahayana literature, and I found it nowhere clearer than in Tsongkhapa himself, with his, you know, consummate knowledge of the Indian sources and the great sources of Tibet. There's this other factor, it's called in Sanskrit prashrapta, or very simply Xinjiang and Tibetan. You can't imagine it unless you've experienced, but it's not mystical. And no one English word captures it. Here's an array. Pliancy's good. Suppleness, very close. Malleability, good. Buoyancy. All three of those, all four of those. If you just wrap those four terms around and try to synthesize them into one, it's not something that is inconceivable at all. It's not like that. But it comes in both physical as well as mental versions. And so physical pliancy, which comes into full blossom when you fully achieve access to the first jhana, this entails a lightness of the body, lightness, buoyancy, suppleness, malleability, pliancy. And those who have achieved shamatha say it is just a wondrous experience in the body. So, and it's so wondrous, you feel like your body is as light as a puff of cotton. You feel as if you could jump over a mountain. And you can't, of course. But you feel that kind of lightness. And that's physical pliancy. And it comes into full bloom. It really then stabilizes when you fully achieve access to the first jhana. And then there's mental pliancy. Take all of those same terms, suppleness and so forth and so on, and apply them to your mind. Your mind is now a world like a world-class gymnast, that you can just do with your mind anything you want. You see, you know, the Olympic athletes in gymnastics and say, what can't you do with your body except for levitate? I mean, just amazing, right? Well, imagine your mind like that, that it's just so supple, so wieldy, so silky, and this occurs when you fully achieve shamatha. And if that hasn't, this is the point he's making here, it's really important. If that hasn't arisen, if the physical and the mental pliancy have not arisen and stabilized, you haven't achieved shamatha. You may be able to sit for 10 hours straight with bliss, luminosity, non-conceptuality. Great, you're still in the desire realm, and that is a facsimile of shamatha, and that's what the Buddha said to Maitreya, so I think we should take that seriously. And then there's the Mahasiddha Ratnakarashanti. He was one of the little, not so well known nowadays, but he was the abbot of Vikramashila, and he was one of the teachers of Atisha, formidable pandit, and he's one of the 80 Mahasiddhas. So he should be much more famous than he is. I'm trying to make him famous. But Tsongkhapa cites a text of his called the Prajna Paramitopadesha. Prajna Paramitopadesha. And so this is one of the definitive commentaries from the Indian Pandit and Mahasiddha traditions. And he writes, and I quote, again, all of these are my translations. Here the bodhisattva dwelling alone in a solitary place brings to mind his intended object. Ridding himself of mental conversation, he repeatedly brings to mind the actual nature of the mind as it appears in that way. So long as physical and mental pliancy do not arise, this is a mental engagement that is a facsimile of shamatha. But when they do arise, that's shamatha. Okay, so this is really the definitive crossing over point. Before then, your samadhi is outstanding. I mean, you say, give me a break. What more do I want than this, you know? And if you want to achieve shamatha, there's a bit more. Why is this important? Because something, it's taking place on these two planes, and that is what is taking place here, which is giving rise to the physical pliancy, is a subtle but very profound and quite robust shift in your whole prana system. The whole system is being like tuned, and it stays tuned unprecedentedly. You'll get foretastes of this, just like you get foretastes of the bliss, luminosity, non-conceptuality along the path. But it stabilizes, and you've shifted the whole the operating system. What else do you call it? The energetic operating system of your body. You've shifted it. And now it's working on another plane altogether. And that shift, because of the profound entanglement of body and mind, that shift in the whole operating system of the prana system throughout the body, that shifts, and as a result of that, there is a corresponding shift in the operation of your mind, and the mind becomes imbued with these same qualities. When that occurs, then you've achieved shamatha. Why is this important? Because that's what you carry with you off the cushion. And unless you do something really stupid, or have an accident, like severe brain damage, or whatever, somebody slips in a massive dose of datura into your drink, and you become crazy for the rest of your life. Apart from doing something stupid, His Holiness told me, you should be able to sustain this for the rest of your life. Now that's robust. That's really robust. So this is going to influence everything from now on. All of your experiences in between sessions, your sleep, your dreaming, and every meditation you ever do is going to have this as the baseline. That body and that mind. And it's because of this profound shift physiologically that it gives rise to the sustainability of this quality of mind. It's a really big deal. Tsongkhapa then himself says in this text, and I received the oral transmission of this from Geshe Ngontage. Just one-on-one, I asked him, I was so brazen, there, thank you. Brazen. She's getting back at me. I've been calling her old lady, brazen. Good. I was brazen. He sat with me and read, it's like a 300-page text. And I simply asked him. I had no money, had nothing. I'm a poor, stupid monk. And he just gave it to me. So, oral transmission. Little snippet from shamatha. Tsongkhapa writes, well then, what plane incorporates the samadhi in which pliancy has not arisen? The samadhi is included in the plane of the desire realm. He continues, all samadhis prior to the achievement of samadhi of the threshold to the first jhana are single-pointed attention of the desire realm. And then he adds, so judging by the great treatises, there seem to be very few who achieve even shamatha. He's writing this in the early 15th century. You can interpret that, obviously, in two ways. That already by the time Tsongkhapa is writing, this was one of his later works, he wrote this after he wrote the great exposition of the stages of the path. One interpretation would be already at the time of Tsongkhapa, the Buddha Dharma had already degenerated so much, you know, close to 2,000 years, that it was just a really degenerate era, and people were just generally so degenerate that hardly anybody even achieved shamatha. That's one interpretation. But then if we consider, look back to that time, 14th century, 15th century, 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th, how many incredible great beings were there? You know, I mean, just an extraordinary number from all the traditions, you know. So that interpretation doesn't wash with me. That, you know, the time is gone, too boo-hoo, it's too degenerate, you can't achieve it anymore, hardly anybody achieves it. Doesn't wash, does not wash with me. And when His Holiness said, and I've quoted him at least once already, to a Westerner, not me, but to somebody else, a European fellow, how can we gain any realization in this degenerate era in the 20th century? And His Holiness said, yeah, it's degenerate, but if you practice like Milarepa, you'll achieve like Milarepa. So I think we really need to hold that in mind. There are a lot of people have already given up. A lot of Tibetans have already given up. I've heard some. Very knowledgeable. Sometimes the more knowledgeable they are, the worse it is. And they say, well, we're in such a degenerate era now. Don't even try to achieve shamatha. You won't achieve it. And vipassana, forget about it. And yeah, get the empowerments. Of course, you can't really do the practices, but, you know, muck around, do your sloppy Joe best, and you'll die. And at least you'll have some good seeds to carry with you. So I've heard that view quite often, you know. And it really strikes me as like, I feel a bit of passion here. It's like what happened to Tibet, to Buddhadham in Tibet, was like a severe automobile accident, you know, a head-on collision. And Buddhadharma was barely survived. And it's like, you know, thrown out of the car and it's bleeding all over the place. And the medics come roaring up and they just say, eh, it's dead. And somebody else comes, no, it's got a pulse. Never mind, it's basically dead. No, but it's got a pulse. Shut up, it's dead. And there are Buddhist teachers in the West, Buddhist teachers in Asia, that are basically saying, yeah, we'll bring you Buddha Dharma, but it's DOA, dead on arrival. That is, you have no chance. Especially you Westerners, you're a bunch of barbarians, you know. You have no chance. If we Tibetans don't have a chance, forget you guys. We're just going to humor you and give you a whole bunch of empowerments. And profanity arises in my mind. But I won't use it. I'll just say, screw that. I'd rather be wrong and believe what I believe than be right with what you believe. So piss off. That's my view, in case you were curious. We go to a sangha, 5th century. And it's Abhidhamma Sambhucaya. What is pliancy? Let's get it from, you know, the greatest authorities we can find. Due to the cessation of the continuum of dysfunctions of the body and mind, the unmalleability, the rigidity, the heaviness of the body and mind, this is fitness of the body and mind, having the function of dispelling all obscurations. The dysfunctions of the body and mind are the unfitness of the body and mind for voluntarily pursuing virtuous deeds. So it has a very real ethical component to it. It's not just being a gymnast. Any resistance, the heaviness, the unwieldiness of the body for engaging in practicing Dharma. Wieldiness, unwieldiness, resistance, heaviness, rigidity of the mind that makes it difficult to devote ourselves to Dharma. That's what I translate as dysfunction. It's daushtulya in Sanskrit, or ningele. Ningele. Ningele even sounds bad. My mind's really feeling a lot of ningele. That can't be good. Well, Xinjiang, definitely better. Then we go to, again, another source quoted by Tsongkhapa, Stiramati, the great 6th century, again, great pundit, great sitta. He explains, the fitness of the body is that from which buoyancy and lightness arise in one's physical actions. The fitness of the mind is the cause of cheerfulness and lightness of the mind, and participates the mind that participates in genuine mental engagement. If one is endowed with this transformative quality that arises from the mind, one engages with the meditative object without resistance. Therefore, this is called fitness of the mind. And the Sangha says, and now in the Shravakabhumi, the portent of the proximate occurrence of gross, easily discernible single-pointedness of mind and of mental pliancy. Okay, what he's describing now is the day you achieve shamatha. It's not going to be kind of, I think it was sometime last week. It's not going to be, it was generally on Tuesday. It's going to be on Tuesday afternoon, Tuesday morning. It's something precipitous, a discontinuity, an abruptness. So as being in a non-lucid dream and the transition from that to lucidity can be quite abrupt, you know exactly when it occurred. When you achieve shamatha, you will remember that day. You remember it quite with some precision. And this is what you'll experience. The portent of the proximate occurrence of gross, easily discernible single-pointedness of mind, that is, what he's really getting at here, you'll see, is you're just about to achieve shamatha. And here's the first sign. The analogy is a woman who's 9 months pregnant, what's the portent of the baby's just about to come? Breaking the water, right? The water breaking. Isn't that pretty kind of a strong indicator? I've never seen it, don't want to. But when they say the water is broke, I've watched television. You know, well, the water is broke. Oh, that means it's not time to watch a soap opera. It's kind of like, get with it. This is the breaking of the water. This is the water breaking. And he's about to describe what that is. What's this portent of the proximate occurrence of shamatha and of mental pliancy is, what is it? A cessation of heaviness on the top of the head. But this is not a harmful symptom. As the oral tradition said, it's not uncomfortable. It's, as the oral tradition said, it's as if you had a bald head and somebody placed a warm hand on top of your head. Not unpleasant, but kind of a heaviness there. So something must be happening interesting in the brain. And we Buddhists don't know what it is, at least I don't. So I want to have somebody achieve shamatha with an EEG cap on. In MRI. Then we'll know the brain correlates of achieving shamatha. Why not? So we're going to have an ambulance on call up there at our observatory. And if somebody says, my water just broke, we're going to put him in an ambulance. Get him to pee. Maybe they won't let me, but you know, you get the idea. Okay, it's heaviness on top of the head, but this is not a harmful symptom. As soon as that happens, mental dysfunction, which is included among the mental afflictions that obstruct delight in illuminating the afflictions, is itself eliminated. That is, that which is opposite of mental fitness, dysfunction, is now gone. And mental fitness and mental pliancy arise due to this antidote, due to its occurrence, vital energies of the great elements that are conducive to the arising of physical pliancy. So I made a slip of the tongue there. It's actually mental pliancy that arises first. It's top down. The mental pliancy arises first because you've been engaging in a mental activity. That's where the juice is, not in some brain activity. The juice is your meditative practice, which is mental. You bring about, you trigger that pliancy in the mind, and that catalyzes the correlated pliancy in the body. That brings forth physical bliss. That triggers mental bliss, like a volcano of bliss. That subsides, and then you've achieved shamatha. That's the sequence of it. But now let's see what Asanga says. Due to its occurrence, vital energies of the great elements that are conducive to the arising of physical pliancy course through the body. Because of their movement, what is freed of physical dysfunction affiliated with mental afflictions that obstruct delight in meditation. And it seems as if the entire body were filled with physical pliancy as the antidote for that. When that first arises, having taken delight in the extraordinary mental joy, in superb mental engagement, there is supreme mental pleasure in accompanying the mental object. So there's the heaviness, there's the mental pliancy. That triggers the physical pliancy. And that triggers an extraordinary degree of mental bliss. In superb mental engagement, there is supreme mental pleasure in accompanying the meditative object. At that time, that is called the mind. You thought you got a mind. You call that a mind? This is the mind. I've been waiting to say that. That's not a mind. This is a mind. This is a real mind. This is the big knife. He said, literally said, at that time, this is called the mind. That which arises immediately thereafter is the force of pliancy, which incrementally becomes subtler. So kind of like a volcanic eruption of bliss has just come up. Right? But if you're just blissed out, you can't do much else. And so it actually needs to subside. So it's kind of like this rapture, like this eruption of bliss comes up, mental bliss. And then it subsides. That which arises immediately thereafter is the force of pliancy, which incrementally becomes subtler. Pliancy occurs in the body, following it like the shadow. The extraordinary mental joy is relinquished. It calms down. The mind, having a serene aspect, becomes stabilized with shamatha, with respect to the meditative object. And that's when you achieve shamatha. That moment right there. The pressure, mental pliancy. Physical bliss, mental bliss, subside. It's like milk that you put on the stove and it boils all over the place and spills all over the place and you turn the heat down and then it just simmers. The simmering milk of shamatha. Getting close to the end here. And then we jump to the 16th century. Wangju Dorje, the ninth Karmapa. A man, again, of tremendous authority, profound realization. And he writes, and I quote, "Thus, due to the experience of bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality, craving for the allures of the desire realm subsides." The next one I haven't seen in any other account. There's no need to eat food. I think he must just be referring to his own experience here, because I've not seen that anywhere else. But your samadhi is so fine, you actually live on the Dingensingese. You live on the food of samadhi. So I don't know how universal that is, but I would say he wouldn't say it if he didn't know at least one person who experienced that. And I imagine that first person is him. So craving for the allures of the desire realm subsides. There is no need to eat food. And the movements of the movements of the respiration are not sensed. In other words, they go extremely subtle, and your awareness of the body is simply ceased. Great joy arises with the thought. Now this is what the Buddha had in mind. And there comes great certainty in thinking of your guru as a Buddha. So this question has come up, you know, what do we need to do to actually see the guru as a Buddha? What do we need to do? What do I need to think? What do we need to imagine? And the answer is just purify your mind. Just purify your mind. And then you will. And I think again he's saying, this just has to be first person. He purified his mind as well, and then he looked at his guru and he saw Buddha. You know. While tainted extrasensory perception, tainted means it still has some tinge of reification, of mental affliction. So while tainted extrasensory perception and paranormal abilities and so on may also come up, do not obsess about them. Don't make a big deal of them. If this experience of single-pointedness is cultivated for a year, afterwards realization will be gained and it will stabilize. Realization here, we can assume the great Mahamudra master, talking about Vipassana, maybe Mahamudra itself, Rigpa. Chief Shamatha, with that base, a year. We're talking about now, as Geshe-la Taiji said, Chief Shamatha, Vipassana, not hard. The best indicator of having firm Shamatha is that one cannot sense movements of the breath or body and cannot even sense whether they are there. So this is exactly what we've heard from Buddhaghosa, Asanga, Vasubandhu, Tsongkhapa, Padmasambhava, Dujomlingpa. So be alert for watered-down versions of shamatha, because that's the norm nowadays. Not many people look into, you know, the gold standard. This is the gold standard. It's not my opinion. It's just true. But so often it gets watered down, and it never water up. You never find people in modern era saying, no, Buddhaghosa didn't get it. Actually, much more difficult than that. No, Tsongkhapa didn't get it. Actually, much higher than Tsongkhapa thought about. Nobody says that. It's always bringing it down to our own level. Because I think people have this intense craving to want to give their practice a label. Anything. So hey, I've been practicing for 10 years. What have I achieved? Oh, hell, let's say I've achieved shamatha. Oh, no, first jhana. No, fourth jhana. No, I think I'm a stream enter. That's it, I'm a stream enter. I've been practicing for 2 years. What the hell? I must have achieved stream enter. Yeah, that's good. That sounds good. I'm a stream enter. Yeah. Really, I'm being a bit sarcastic here, but we're just watering down all over the place. So at least know the gold standard and then compare this to anybody else. And then see who speaks with a greater authority. I have none. So it's not me versus anybody else. I have none. But I know how to translate. My Manikaya, definitely iPhone. So, read that again. The best indicator of having firm shamatha is that one cannot sense the movements of the breath or body and cannot even sense whether they are there. The middling indicator is that they are sensed only if examined, and the lowest indicator is that one is not bothered by the movements of the breath or the weight of the body. So, best, middling, and low. That's what he said. And this is his classic treatise, The Ocean of Definitive Meaning. And my interpretation, that's it, that's what he said. And so open interpretation. My interpretation here is when he said best, that's the gold standard. That's what best means, the gold standard. But when he says middling or lower, what I'm suggesting here is that's not shamatha. It's not shamatha, because shamatha is shamatha. But it's something less, maybe stage 7, maybe stage 8, something like that. And that would be middling or lower. But then does this mean that if you're following the path of Mahamudra, which he teaches, of course, that's a text about Mahamudra, that you just don't need to achieve shamatha? And that just can't be true. I mean, just because the first yoga out of four yogas is the union of shamatha vipassana, not crappy shamatha or low grade shamatha or false fixed limited shamatha, but actually shamatha. And so my strong interpretation here, and I'd stand by it, is when he speaks of these lesser modes, middling and lowest indicator, he's saying, okay, get that far. And now if you're satisfied, if you really want to get in the saddle and practice vipassana, then go for it. You don't have to necessarily wait to fully achieve shamatha before you really immerse yourself in vipassana. But when you do immerse yourself in vipassana, make sure you finish the unfinished business and achieve shamatha fully on emptiness. But for heaven's sakes, achieve it. Otherwise, you do not have the union of shamatha vipassana. You have a false facsimile, and you don't have the path. If you can go even deeper than that, as indicated in some Dzogchen lineages, you've achieved some degree of shamatha. Your mind's not totally flaky, maybe the middling or lower. And then you just go for non-meditation, just right there, having well been introduced to the view and so forth of Dzogchen. You may freshly achieve shamatha in non-meditation. Shamatha within Rigpa, realizing Rigpa. That's a possibility too, for sure. But one way or another, finish it. That's that. Hola, so. So the morning sessions will be 20 minutes late. We'll start at 10:20. But that was it. That was shamatha, gold standard. And you'll have it by tonight, the notes.